Hola. All right, we will get started. This is what we call cases from the clinic. And yesterday, yesterday the cases that I came up with are really, I sort of do a all-year collection of questions that come up as we're seeing patients in the clinic, and then I try to take the ones that I think are the most controversial and then throw it into the talk. But obviously there's a lot others that either I've done in the past and I took out, or other people in this conference we're going to be covering, or there just wasn't room. So what I thought we could do in the next 57 minutes is hear from you. I have things prepared in case you want to, for me to be more direct in taking us through topics, but I thought what we could do is just kind of hear from you about what are the conundrums that you're facing. And knowing this audience in general, the likelihood is that there isn't an answer, right? But, you know, coming to a conference and hearing that is helpful, because at least when I was a chief resident back at UAB in the 80s, we had to organize grand rounds, and I used to sit up in front after inviting a speaker in, and I was all excited about that person. And I remember as the speaker was presenting, I'd be up front on the right side, and I kind of glance back at the audience and kind of think about what is it they're taking away from this. And the cynical answer was after 3 to 4 weeks, when the talk was over and I bumped into one of those folks and said, "What do you remember?" He said, "I remember there was some expert about rheumatology and something to do with gout, and that's a person who I'll probably call if I have a question." I thought, that's okay. And they don't remember details of what they had to say. And the second thing is that I looked around at the audience and thought, what is it, why are people here? You know, why do they want an update on whatever? And my answer there was a little bit more, a little bit less cynical. And that is that when people are busy taking care of patients, time is flying by. Back in those days, we still had paper journals. Now we don't seem to have that anymore. We just have PDFs or something. But I don't know about you guys, but for me, they would stack up, you know, in my office at home or on my desk, there were these stacks, and, oh, I'll get to that over the weekend, right? And so I would never get to read on stuff. And so I started feeling guilty. So because there could be something that came up that I wouldn't know the answer to, and the question in my mind was, do I not know the answer because I hadn't kept up? Or do I not know the answer because the answer isn't known? And to me, that's the purpose of CME at the end of the day. Because nobody keeps up with everything. Nobody. I don't care who they are. And people that are sort of in the education business, I guess, or giving us a talk, and yourselves included, you prepare for the talk and you read about stuff and you make yourself get caught up on that one area, but that doesn't mean you're caught up in every area. So even attending the conference as a speaker, you're still learning and validating what you don't know as either coming in that category of, I don't know it because I hadn't kept up, and that's okay, now you get sort of, you learn that. Or more commonly, you don't know something because it isn't known. So coming back to the beginning of when I started here in this talk, in this session, those questions that I put up there, oftentimes there isn't a firm answer. There's opinion, and that's it. And so that's what I tried to do. That's why I have a panel, because as you saw from David's talk, which was very comprehensive today in the same hour time period, he gave you data to support everything he said. And so there's pretty firm answers there. The types of questions I was asking, there weren't. So happy to get into whatever. Let's just take a show of hands. Would you prefer for me to present case scenarios to you and then let you discuss? Or would you rather, we only have now 50 minutes left. I blew 7 of it, sorry. Or would you rather just bring up topics and we discuss it as a group?
Maybe a combination of both.
Oh, combination. Okay. All right. I'll start. Here's a case. There's a guy who you get referred, and he's now in his early 60s, and he was infected probably in the 80s and came into the system in 1991 or two, and then went through the serial D drugs and went through the protease inhibitors and the non-nukes, and now he's on some cockamamie regimen that's hard. You know, you can just imagine. It's like it's mega heart with darunavir that's boosted and dolutegravir and etravirine and TDF plus FTC, and that's it. So it's like a lot of drugs. And the first thing that you're wondering is, does he need all that? So I'll turn to you guys and say, how would you begin to approach that problem? Yeah, how's he doing? He's doing okay. His viral load's suppressed. His CD4 count's in the 300s. He hates taking all these medicines, some of which he's taking twice a day. And you don't have any data. He just showed up. At our place, they have an intake visit before they see a provider. And during that, they get oriented to the clinic and they get told about, you know, you can go see the chaplain if you want to pray for your health while you come see us, that type of thing. That was meant to be a joke. Well, maybe they do need that. And probably do. But there's no genotype, right?
Look at how long he's been on the regimen.
Yeah, so he tells you he's been on this regimen for 3 years. But he has no clue how he got there.
He has hepatitis B.
Good question.
You know, that archive?
No, well, you don't have anything. You have nothing. He's suppressed. But you don't have any data.
Oh, probably do an archive, genotype archive, to see if there's any resistance, and maybe simplify.
Okay, so you suggest getting a DNA resistance test. Mm-hmm. Okay, how many people would probably do that? His viral load's undetectable now. Yeah, so you can't do a plasma DNA. Yeah. Yeah, you ask him what he tolerated in the past. He told you that he hated DDI. DDC gave him some peripheral neuropathy, but he doesn't remember any hypersensitivity reaction. Yeah.
I'd ask him when they've changed your medications over the years, did they ever tell you they changed it because it wasn't working?
Yeah.
Or were they changing?
So the question is, did you ever change? He says, yeah, they did that a couple times, but I don't remember what I was on. That sound real? Does to me, yes. He skips some meds, yeah. So he doesn't take the medicines that make him feel like shit. That sound okay? Right. And then you ask him which ones they are, and he says, oh, it's that yellow pill from, 30 years ago or something. Yeah. Okay. That's a good idea. Try to get some information. Call them. Yep. So you do that, and they disconnected the phone.
Probably he's not exposed to an integrase, so that's a new class that you can...
Yeah, so she's saying the integrase is probably okay.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
So
the question is, does he need the dolutegravir once a day or twice a day? That's kind of the question, right?
Once a day.
Once a day you go for, okay?
If it's suppressed, it will do once a day.
Yeah, if he's suppressed, right? So there is no answer. I mean, the DNA genotype is there. But what's cool, and I thought this would happen with this audience, is you guys know a lot more than maybe you give yourself credit for. I mean, you guys are really good at what you do. You're out there. You're doing this every day. So when you come to a meeting like this, you're really kind of fine-tuning your knowledge. There's a few people I met in the elevator for 30 seconds on the way down. On the way up, it seems to take longer. I don't know, 45 seconds. And so they were just new to the field. One was a PA who was doing primary care before and now is doing HIV care for the last 6 months or so. And so for that person, this meeting is sort of a logarithmic growth in knowledge. But I think for most of you who have been doing this for years. The hardest part, I think, is keeping up with what's new in primary care rather than what's new in HIV medicine, right? But like that HB, the zoster vaccine, it's pretty cool. I've been waiting for mine for that particular formulation because I don't want to take the old one. And I'm right on the precipice of that, yeah.
So that patient you just mentioned,
yeah.
I've had a couple of cases where the infection is undetectable and you look back and you see some old genotypes with three or four resistances.
Right.
And I get a DNA and it shows pan sensitive.
Yep.
So
the question is, you get a guy like this, and we have two scenarios. We ordered that DNA. A lot of times it comes back pan-sensitive. And you go, huh? And the issue is it's a relative archive situation. So to do that test, they take the patient's peripheral blood, isolate out the mononuclear cells, extract the DNA, you know, lyse the cells, get the DNA, and then they run a genotype on it. Remember that the genotype is a population thing. So it will amplify what's there, but the thing that dominates is what is the majority. So this guy was originally infected in the 80s. His dominant sort of latent pool is made up of wild-type virus. So it depends on how much he had exposure and failure and for how long, how much of that population got taken over by the resistant population. So it's a relative thing. If you do single genome assessment, which it's hard to get commercially, you might start seeing something. But I would, George, I'd take that situation and say, guy's doing pretty well. I think to get to cut to the chase to allow you guys have the time for bring up your scenarios. To cut to the chase, I think what I would do in that case is I would start playing with reducing. So maybe the first thing I do is hepatitis B infected. Probably get them off the TDF to TAF because that's probably going to be a little bit more effective and less toxic. He's in his early 60s. He's probably headed for some kidney trouble just because. And why not? Not to mention bone. If he was a woman in particular, I'd do that, right? And then I'd just each visit, I'd try to sort of see what I could concoct that was more simplified with an eye towards frequent visits, frequent viral loads, watching for failure. And the chances are he's going to do fine as you reduce. So maybe go to once-day dolutegravir. Keep the darunavir, keep the TAF. That's probably what his regimen is going to end up being. Once a day TAF, FTC, once a day dolutegravir, once a day darunavir, and stop. And if you really want to be bold, you could possibly drop the boosted darunavir. But you could probably get rid of the etravirine and be okay. But it's a guess. And it reminds me of my favorite scene from Robin Hood Men in Tights. I quote this on rounds with Hal Staff all the time. Did anybody see that movie? Robin Hood, Mel Brooks, sure. All right, for those of you who didn't, it's a silly movie like most movies that I like. And there's a character, obviously there's Robin Hood. He's wearing tights. And then one of his men is Blinken, right? And Blinken's a blind guy who's wearing like John Lennon blue tinted glasses. And he's walking around like this all the time. So one day Robin Hood's riding back, and Blinken, the blind guy, is outside their fort looking out, the blind guy. And Robin Hood rides up and goes, "Blinken, what are you doing up there?" And he goes, "I'm guessing. I'm guessing that no one is coming. And so we're guessing." And, and that's uncomfortable. We're trained to be precise, right? We're trained to be data-driven, but clinical medicine requires us to guess. And as long as we're uncomfortable when we guess, we're doing a good job. When we get comfortable guessing and acting, then we're in trouble. We're going to make a lot of mistakes that way. So your gut is what tells you when it's... You should be cringing as you remove one of these medicines, or because you're just dealing in the unknown. but you're making an educated guess. You're doing all the right things. But that clinical sense of guessing, and you should be really uncomfortable, which makes you see him more frequently as opposed to, we'll do this. You'll probably find C in 6 months. Yeah, you ain't going to do that. Yeah.
Bounces up a little bit.
Add it back.
Just add back.
Retreat. Wave the flag. Yeah. So that's.
What if they only go up to like 50?
See him back more often. But the 50 is probably not going to stay there for long. If he really needed that drug, he's going to spike to at least over 300. And once he goes above 300, you know that that's bad. The little blipping probably is related to how high his initial viral load was before he ever got treated. So if it's in the millions before he got treated and he has a CD4 count of 17, those are the people that are, you'll never get less than 20, or you won't consistently keep them there. Okay. All right, that's one movie reference for those of you keeping score. Great. Case here.
Boy,
this is like a real case. There's data.
Trying to figure out what's going on with him. So I saw this patient. It was after like seeing three different doctors. He was diagnosed in 2015 with HIV, and he's very nice. He's a very nice guy. He was working full-time job and everything. And then he was diagnosed in 2015, and he was placed on Jumboya. So he started to feel very weak after the treatment. He was CD4 count was below 50. That's what he said. And I don't know his initial viral load. And he was pan sensitive, so he was started on Jumboya. And after he was started on Jumboya, he started feeling like his muscles were aching all the time. He was very weak.
How old is he?
Like 33.
Oh.
So he changed doctors and saw another doctor. So they changed his regimen and they put him on Epsicon, Reatas, and Norvir. But he kept feeling exactly the same. So that's when he came to see me, and he was already undetectable. T cells were already almost over 200, and they had work him up with like CPKs, aldolase, trying to figure out if he had like a myopathy or some sort, and they couldn't figure it out. They sent him to rheumatology. They woke him up. Everything was negative. He was sent to mental health, and he's seen a psychiatrist and some depression medication.
Crazy.
They thought he was crazy. So I put him back on the Jumboya just because, you know, I didn't
think... You wanted to torture him.
I didn't think that, you know, I couldn't figure out what was going on.
Right.
So... later, more investigation, I ordered like an lactic acid. The lactic acid was a little high, so I like took off the NRTI and put him on another regimen. And so here's where we are right now. They did a complete workup, and now we're getting a muscle biopsy to see if he has any myopathy.
Okay.
But we're not trying. We don't know exactly. I don't know exactly what's going on with him.
All right.
But you can't touch him. You touch him, it hurts.
Okay.
What is this total CK?
CK was...
It was normal.
Normal.
He wasn't on Bactrim or anything like that for prophylaxis?
He is...
So I got a question. Is it too late to hold on the muscle biopsy?
No.
Okay. I could ask around the room. How would you like this? Would you like group therapy here, where we beat up on each other, or you want me to kind of go ahead? Yes.
If we're dealing with myopathy or polymyositis, there are really a variety of factors and different ways of polymyositis exhibiting or presenting clinically. And I've seen patients with negative CPKs but elevated aldolase and myoglobin. So before you rule out that based on one single test, I would go back.
And that was all normal.
If it's all negative, then it's not myopathy.
I would agree with that. That's why I asked about the muscle biopsy.
Muscle biopsy.
So here's, I sure want to get to a lot of cases. here's kind of my reaction to what you said. The two regimens he's been on have one thing in common, and that is that you've poisoned the hell out of his normal metabolism systems with cobicistat initially, then ritonavir, and now back to cobicistat. What we haven't done yet is given his body a chance to be free of that. So what I'm sensing as a first knee-jerk gut reaction is maybe we should try a regimen that doesn't involve any of the boosting. And I was kind of hinting at that at the lecture. Remember when I said the top six regimens? And I was pained when I was writing. I mean, I was almost took it out, but I left it in because I figured I'll be accused of being a drug company biased person. So I wanted to include the other company, Janssen, in there, right? So just to make it, you know, have a nice equipoise. But the fact is, we poison the metabolism system with those COBI or ritonavir because we need higher drug levels for those drugs to work. And back in the day when we didn't have other alternatives, that was a good thing to do because they're pretty good drugs once you get the levels up. But I think we're at a time where we don't necessarily need to do that. We've got dolutegravir that's a pretty good drug. Raltegravir is a pretty good drug. Pills were kind of big, but now we got this once daily two pills. And I don't know about you, I'm finding that when I really ask patients, what bothers you more, taking more than one pill in the morning or taking a pill twice a day? And how many people's folks say mostly the twice a day bothers me more? Yeah, yeah. But taking two pills, hell, I take five pills a day, right? I'm not sure what, I don't even know what they're for. I just pop them. Here, take this. All right, fine. I keep hallucinating, and I don't know what it is. But no, seriously. So I think dolutegravir, the bictegravir, raltegravir, are all going to be just fine. And maybe elvitegravir has seen its day. You know, maybe it's dying, in what it can do. Does that mean people that are on? I guess we're in a workshop, so I can say trade names. People that are on Stribild or Genvoya, are we going to take them off? Not necessarily. It's sort of like Atripla, but watch, they'll start. Watch this carefully. As Gilead releases bictegravir, all of a sudden, Genvoya and they're going to become evil. Look what they did to their own. They cannibalized TDF with TAF. I mean, I've never... GlaxoSlashViv spent 12 years trying to destroy tenofovir. Gilead destroyed it in 10 days. Amazing, right? And so I think those drugs are headed for some secondary role. So I don't know. That back to your case. I would lean towards just trying it, a dolutegravir, TAF, FTC, see what happens. And it might be that he just turns right around. Because if I heard you right, he was an okay guy pre-therapy. He just had HIV. And then suddenly gets put on Genvoya and he feels like shit, right? And now he's on a ritonavir thing and he feels bad. And then you put him back on Genvoya and it's all this, only maybe getting worse. Yeah. Does that sound reasonable?
He wasn't taking his statins?
No. Well, that's how old he was. Yeah, because... Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, everybody following that? I mean, because the COBI and the ritonavir boost the statin levels. One thing they do really well that we shouldn't overlook, COBI and ritonavir do a great job of boosting antidepressants. So a lot of times, if you know, really looking carefully, you start somebody on Genvoya, assuming they don't have this muscle problem, And suddenly they come back and say, wow, I feel really good, the depressed patient. And it's because they're finally getting levels that are therapeutic. Most of you have been to enough of these conferences where you've seen Glenn Treisman talk, right? What a lot of you may remember him at Hopkins, right? Pretty funny guy, great stories and all that. If we have time at the end, I'll do my impression of him. And he is not only a psychiatrist, he has a PhD in pharmacology. And what he told me, what I learned from him was really important, that when antidepressants or any psychiatric drugs are approved, they go for an 8-week therapeutic effect at the lowest possible dose. And the reason they use the lowest possible effective dose is because they have to measure enough to see an effect without toxicity. But rarely will they ever push the dose to where it needs to go. So if you think about package inserts, all they can do is put in the package insert what the trial showed. So a lot of our antidepressants are way underdosed. Now, for us, that is the non-psychiatrist, to start pushing that dose higher is probably not malpractice, but poor practice. Or it could be malpractice. So I don't know enough about these drugs to know which ones, but he does. And a lot of times he has success where I failed. I've sent him patients because he knew that it's okay to push that dose of X, Y, or Z. We fall into a great accident when we sometimes put people on a Cobia or ritonavir and they're on pick your antidepressant of choice besides trazodone or something that's metabolized by the liver, right? Yeah, and they suddenly feel great. Conversely, you could take them off and they feel worse because he's not on any other concomitant medicines.
But my point is, because I didn't finish one part, he did have an electrophysiological study with nerve conduction and muscle study, and the neurologist feels that the patient has a myositis.
Did he what?
That the patient has a myositis.
He thinks he has a myositis.
But
do we still think that's because of the
medication? I would try something without the Kobe, personally.
Okay.
Because I think that's a, and it may be that, you know, dead wrong, I'm guessing, right? It's just a guess. But I've seen enough. How many of you were involved in any antiretroviral drug trials over the years, right? And were you involved in any of these that were early in development, like a phase 1-2, right? And when you're dealing with a phase 1-2 study, I don't know, I always was nervous about starting something on anyone because it just, there's a lot of times things pop up that you just never expected. And so that's the one thing that I think about in this setting, that perhaps he is having a reaction. And yes, these drugs, you wonder why the efficacy in clinical trials is now 90% for the mostly the integrase inhibitors, and for the non-nukes it was maybe 80%, and for the boosted PIs never got above 85%. And the reason for that is that they're all done by intent to treat, which means that once you start somebody, you've randomized them, even if they never take the medicine, they count. And you look at 48 weeks, you do your snapshot analysis, and those who are still taking their medicines at 48 weeks are having success or they're not. And the main reason why they oftentimes aren't taking their medicine is because of toxicity. And the newer drugs is a lot more. So comment on that case again or no? Yeah.
With the older antiretroviral drugs, we used to see a lot of so-called mitochondrial toxicity.
Yes.
I'm wondering, we're not so attuned to that anymore, but I'm wondering that to that degree, does that still occur?
Yeah, it can.
What agents would you be more concerned about?
Yeah. So that's you wisely checked the lactic acid, and that would be the thing that would be an indirect, if not direct.
That's why I checked the lactic acid. It was a little high, so I took
an
NRTI.
Yeah, yeah.
NRTI-sparing regimen, but it didn't make any difference.
Yeah.
So the only thing I haven't done is taking off.
I would get off a booster and see what
happens.
I had a
patient.
Will you email me and let me know what happens?
And I didn't know exactly. I haven't figured this out. But the patient had an IgE of 18,000 with a syndrome of polymyositis. He was also...
He had strongyloides.
Severely compromised at the time because he wasn't taking his HIV medications. So I thought, maybe this will go away once he does control his HIV. He did control the HIV. The IgE went down from 18,000 to 7,000 and 5,000, but it stayed there, and I have no explanation for that. And I don't know. Now, the fellow, the myopathy resolved, but he's still with unable to walk
he's
properly.
He's eating raw pork, or he's, I'm just kidding.
No hyper eosinophilia. But IgE, pure IgE, isolated.
I don't know that we'll solve it. Yes, Jose.
I have a number of I have a number of patients, and as you know, I treat a lot of people from Central America, South America, and so on and so forth, who have IgE elevated, who are HIV positive, and I do the strong Loyd's antibody, and they are positive.
Yeah.
I have started to treat those.
Yeah.
And they get better. Their IgE eventually goes down. Yes.
Yeah.
Any comment on that? Do you have much experience?
Not as much as you do. No, I think it's a reasonable thought. But anyway, I don't know the answer. I think an IgE workup is appropriate, and that's a whole different kind of thing. And George had his hand up.
Yeah. I may have focused too much on this, but you said you can't touch him.
I can't.
And that's not a muscle problem, you know, if you can't touch the person.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think there has to be an element of suggestibility here. And we often send these people to psychiatrists, and suggestibility is not a psychiatric illness. But the one thing I would say that I think might be relevant is if you make this change, Dr. Saga suggested, you should tell him that that there's this substance in your medication
we're getting rid of.
That we're getting rid of, and it's really likely to help you if we do this.
This is magic. And then as they leave, wave a wand. Heal. Okay. So let's go here.
I'm new to the field, by the way.
Oh.
My name is Safwat Nasrat. I'm a physician working like primary care physician and faculty in a residence program. We do everything. We do a little bit of HIV, like a small town called Johnstown, Pennsylvania.
Oh, good.
Johnstown. So I had a case in the beginning of my HIV career, similar way he was on Bactrim and antiretroviral. And he came with severe muscle pain, and we checked his, that's why I asked for this total CK. It was so high. So he is in rhabdomyolysis. Yeah. I looked it up because I don't have any experience. I found that the Bactrim itself can cause rhabdo and can cause also myalgia.
Mm-hmm.
So both of them.
Yeah.
So that's why I think also we have to put into consideration maybe this is a side effect of the Bactrim at that time, especially he was on Bactrim because CD4 count was very low.
Yeah.
So maybe this is one of the reasons. There is some other stuff like polymyositis rheumatica, something like this. Maybe also, especially he is tender everywhere, so we have to put it into consideration.
Yeah. I mean, back in the day, we saw a lot of rheumatologic or autoimmune type diseases that were appearing in HIV. So it wouldn't surprise me if that guy. But what you described sounds a lot like it's a Bactrim toxicity. So you stopped the Bactrim and he got better? Amazing. Amazing. So you also waved the wand when he left and said, you will heal.
Actually, the rhabdo resolved, but the pain and the tenderness still with him.
Huh.
This was a month ago, so I don't know how he is going with the time. Maybe it's like long-term myositis also as a result of using the Bactrim.
Huh. Yeah, could be. Other cases, other thoughts? Yes, in the back of the room. Yes. What area code are you in today?
Yes. Hi, my name is Katya. I'm from Harbor UCLA over at LA County. And so mine is more as a stylistic question, and I was wondering what people would do. I have a 65-year-old monolingual Spanish-speaking lady that comes to clinic, and she had been doing relatively okay. Adherence had always been a little bit off on a PI-based therapy. Following her husband's passing, her adherence became very, very poor. She complained a lot of GI side effects, so I switched her over to a different medication at the time. I switched her over to Complera because I thought her tolerability would be better, and that would be the reason that she would increase her adherence. Over the last 2 to 3 years, I mean, her viral loads are always, always high. She clearly doesn't take her medications, but she comes to the clinic every single time, and she tells you, no, I will take my medications. Please prescribe it for me. Yet she doesn't, right? So I don't know. I mean, she's clearly depressed, won't connect with mental health. And I was wondering what people would do in this scenario. Like, do you withhold the medication? I mean, obviously, recently I've been like, shoot, I probably should not have her on Complera because even if she just take it a couple of times, could that set her up for resistance? But she doesn't take her medications based on her viral loads.
Yeah.
So I was wondering what people would do. Like, the scenario is very frustrating.
I want to hear, too. Let me ask one clarifying question, or two, really. One is that she was doing fine with her viral load before her husband died.
She was doing relatively okay, like the PI-based therapy. So her husband would help her much more in taking her medications.
I guess my second question was, did she really like her husband? I guess she did.
So she has a very
kidding.
Large
that's
family.
A, that's meant to be a joke. Sorry.
And so, and it's usually okay. her daughters that are right. very, like, Mom, you should be taking your medications.
Okay.
But
so what would the, what do you guys think? You have this, yeah, please. Is there an element of dementia?
her depression, so formally no, but and she does very well in terms of taking, she takes care of like her 15 grandchildren, and she's very on top of things. Yeah. Then.
Do they live
so
in a shoe?
They know, right? It's a very, I mean, classic Latino family in Los Angeles type stuff. Her daughters all depend on her for childcare.
Wow.
So she has a lot of
that's pretty stressful.
It is very stressful.
Yeah. Well, keep the microphone. I'll translate the questions from
okay.
up here.
Thank
so
you.
Let's go. Yeah, let's go, yeah, here, then here. Yeah.
We use a lot of adherence and behavior change, motivational interviewing.
Motivational interviewing is suggested.
Yes. So recently I've gotten into motivational interview, and I'm doing it like crazy for every patient. And so with her, you know, we talk about what her goals are, and, you know, I've even offered if you're choice is to not take medications, and her CD4 count now is like 50-something. If your choice is to pass away from AIDS, we could work on that together, right? And she's always like, no, no, doctora, like, I want to take my meds. I need to be alive.
Okay.
I was wondering if the Delilah speaks Spanish, but I can tell she speaks Spanish.
So you speak Spanish?
I do.
Si.
Okay.
Sometimes
that makes a difference.
Yeah, oh, no, I agree completely. My Spanish is... I ended up saying, do you not go to the bathroom
Spanish,
in Los Banos?
Like,
and, yeah.
The culture of connection.
Yeah.
Like, sometimes I get patients that are super non-compliant from other providers, but when I get them, like, you know, you can get into talking.
So you have your phone number available for us? And, no, you're right. It makes a big difference. And it makes a difference where somebody's from. So there could be somebody from Mexico versus South America versus Spain versus... And it, you know, it's a culture. It feels more comfortable when you're talking
sometimes
to somebody.
Right.
No, it's a good. It's a good point, Michael.
I like what the physician was talking about this morning. He was talking about patients who just won't be adherent, about leading a horse to water.
Oh, right. The leading horse to water scenario. Yeah.
Yeah. And I have offered multiple times for her to go see in psychology. She'll no show her appointments.
Right.
She's past the point of needing a psychiatrist at this point, but and she won't go to her psychiatrist appointment because that's not in her culture.
Right.
And that's not what she told me.
Right.
It's what she told me.
So you know, you put the two comments for those in the back of the room. So the point was about Giordano's talk this morning where he talked about leading a horse to drink and that type of thing. And there's lots of reasons. And in this woman's case, it may be that I'm putting both comments together, that maybe she's fine with you as a provider, but if you refer her to a psychologist, she may not relate, right, or a psychiatrist, and then you're not really treating the depression. Other thoughts? Yes.
Are there stigma or disclosure issues within her large family, and are sometimes, if you look hard, you can sometimes find a family member who might take the place of her husband in being her support system in terms of taking her antiretrovirals.
Yeah, that's a great point.
But stigma is
all
such a big...
All her children are what?
Are aware.
Aware, good. Who's the oldest child?
So there's a female is the oldest child. But
still lives at home? Okay.
So there was a certain point where one of the daughters would go home every day and move from work to make sure that she took her medications. And during that time, the viral load didn't come down.
Amazing. Right. So actually, that was going to be my suggestion. When I heard, I mean, I think we should get to another case. But to me, all these comments are spot on. And I would summarize it by saying she had a major grief. Appropriate loss. I mean, just a huge loss, right? And maybe she's having a normal grief reaction. Maybe it's a pathologic grief reaction. And a psychiatrist is going to be helpful, or at least a psychologist. But in addition, she's got huge life stressors. Stigma is probably big time at play. But also, she's got a lot of responsibility. And I think there's two ways that I've leveraged, sort of like what you did, is the motivational interviewing was suggested, but the notion of not exactly guilting her, but kind of gently saying, you know, you're very important to your family, and we need to work together to make sure you're here with them and for them, and get the motivation there. And then I would charge one of the older kids to be her guardian of sorts for medications. And you've done that, and I think that's going to be as successful as anything. The question is, what regimen? Whatever she likes, seriously. And I would give her total control. You know, I'm sure you all have the same thing in our clinic. On the back of almost every door is a picture. I said, "Come on, let's go take a trip to the closet, and here's our choices. Which of these look like they're the right ones for you?" And I don't point them. I let them choose, right? But if they choose one that I know is not going to work, I'm not sure that one's going to work. Let's try another one. But if they pick one, I like the color. You know, it's like going out and picking out shoes. You know, you let them, if they choose, they're vested. I use that all the time. By them actively picking, it reinforces that they're in control. And part of stigma, part of this whole thing, loss is all about regaining control. And putting her in control any way you can is healing, in my experience. So I try to find anything I can do, and I don't know if it's formal. I've never been trained in motivational interviewing, but it feels right, right? It just giving them control and letting them decide as much as I possibly can helps. But I love the idea of taking advantage of one of those 15 kids, or maybe more than one, and letting them take ownership as well.
It's called finding an ally.
An ally, yeah.
Can we send home nursing or something that might help?
Home nesting?
Home nursing.
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Like
home nursing.
Give her the medication in the morning.
You could if it got bad enough, but that's an outsider coming in, and it may or may not be received. It depends on who it is, right? But that could work. But she's got 15 home nurses or nurse of some sort, right? Jose.
I was going to say it's funny what goes on through people's heads, and I've had a number of patients that really kind of test you as to, do I really need to take all these medicines? And they'll stop one antiretroviral, and they come in, and they're still undetectable, and then they'll stop the other one. Yeah. And 5 months down the line, or a year, you find out, well, your viral load has really gone up. I says, well, I stopped them. Yeah. Because, you know, and these are games that people play. And I have found that in delivering the message that you need to take your medicine all the time, I also tell them the way you're taking it now, it's going to hurt you, and you're going to develop resistance. So if you're not committed to taking it all the time, and whatever it takes to do that, we'll do.
Yeah.
But I'm going to stop it until you're ready to do that.
Yeah.
And I think that really sends a message that, you know, I need to take this.
Great. Other cases, other things you want to? Yeah, let's go to the back. Yeah.
African patient who I've known for many years. He's in his 40s. He did very well for a while and then moved away and stopped taking his meds, came back to me, extremely low T-cell count with pneumocystis, put him on dolutegravir, darunavir, and ritonavir. I think he had maybe some resistance, or we just wanted to minimize pills, or something like that.
Yeah,
he did well. His T cells came up. His viral load gradually went down, a little slower than I'm used to with that particular regimen. But it nadired, his viral load nadired around 600 or 1,000. From there, it's only gone up. He's currently at about 1 million. And we did we have an adherence person at work who calls him up And we also checked his pharmacy records, and he's picking up every month.
Resistance test?
Pan-sensitive.
Okay.
Wild type.
Really different. That's really a tough case.
Yeah.
So it's either he's not taking his medicine, which probably is the case.
He gets offended every time I suggest that. He knows the name of the meds, too.
Well, then maybe I would guess that's the case. Even though dolutegravir and darunavir have very high barriers of resistance, relatively speaking, as you heard yesterday, it happens with each of them.
But
you know, it's interesting. A lot of folks at our place are using what I call the double D regimen, because it avoids nukes and all that.
Yeah.
But there are no studies, and I don't even think there's any underway that I mean, maybe in Spain or Argentina or something where they oftentimes do these types of avant-garde studies. I haven't heard of it even there. It makes sense that it might work, but I'm haunted by the recollection of the raltegravir-darunavir study that actually people did worse. And then just raltegravir and two nukes. And I'm not sure, but
I probably have about 20 patients on it.
Yeah.
And he's the only one that's failed. Not undetectable.
Yeah. But I guess at the end of the day, I think you can look him in the eye and say, I trust you, but obviously this regimen is not working. It's failing. Let's try something else. And I think you're going to go with, is there any reason that you can't try the do you think it's multiple tablets, or do you think it's that it's a toxicity that he might be encountering, or you don't know? Don't know.
You know.
What do others think, George?
I had a patient like this that I couldn't figure out if they were really taking their meds, and they probably weren't, but
I found an excuse to put him on valproic acid because I could measure the level of valproic acid, and I gave him full therapeutic doses, and it was zero.
Okay, well, that's a bad drug to take. I'm just kidding. I've never heard of that. That's actually interesting.
You could
actually send off for levels. That's another thought.
Yeah.
But in some ways, that's kind of confrontational, and I think you can, you know, whatever it is ain't working, so you're not going to want to keep him on that. So, again, I'd pick a regimen with him. And what was he on before, when he was doing so great before he left you?
I don't recall right off the top
that
of my head, but there was a reason that I switched him to what he's on. I just don't recall that.
Yeah. Yes, please. Yeah, if his butt can handle it. Right. We didn't talk about this. Yeah, this is something I don't know if Tripp got into today because I had to take a conference call on when he gave the new drugs. You saw a lot of very promising long-acting drugs, right? He talked about the Caspid. CS1 or whatever, the Gilead Caspid inhibitor, that's kind of cool. Has two different mechanisms of action. It has no possibility for oral administration. Zero. Has to be done by injection. And it was, in fact, designed that way because they wanted a longer-acting injectable as a profile that was potent. They were surprised when they discovered, oh, there's two mechanisms of action here. Great. So it's like a search, you know, two mints in one. Remember that commercial? Anyway, so it's a little bit like that. So that could be an injectable. That Merck MK80-something, the guy from Pennsylvania says, good, all right. And so that's also kind of long-acting. It's got a long half-life. And then any drug, actually, I'll get to this in a minute. Let me stop there. So here's the issue. If you're going to use that caspid inhibitor and it's going to last for 3 months and you're going to inject it, and it's, let's say it's low volume, it could be done sub-Q with, you know, half a milliliter. What happens if it's in there and there's an adverse drug reaction? You know, you're going to send it to the surgeon and root around and say, get that out of there. No, it ain't going to work. So especially if it's a Stevens-Johnson or something like that, that guy's going to – you can't stop the Stevens-Johnson. It's going to die, right? So
I'm wondering about implantable
devices. So that's where I'm leading, right? So since you can't do the lead-in, that's the beauty of the ropivirine, and you can use a cabo even as an oral and check it before you dose escalate or go to the injectable. But what I think we're going to see is exactly what you said, Jose, that there's going to be device that is small, I'm guessing about the size of a wafer, bigger than communion, but a little wafer about yay big. And they'll come to the clinic every 6 months, and somebody will be trained, or a bunch of people will be trained, to just kind of put a little lidocaine in, make a small incision, put it in under the skin at a spot, maybe have it be radio opaque so you can find it if you need to. Maybe one stitch, better yet, get some of that plastic stitching, you know, and there it goes. Put a little Band-Aid on it, say don't swim for a day or two, and there you go. And that'll work for 6 months. How many people think, assuming you're trained and can do that, how many people think that that would be attractive for patients?
Some patients.
Maybe not all, but for a lot. And for maybe, well, no, they'd be yelling at you because they hurt. ow! Damn! Yeah. What was the quote?
He's thinking about a device where you can refill it.
Yeah, you could do like a reservoir, like an put it up here in their brain and just inject it right there like an Amaya reservoir. That'd be fun. No, you're right. But here's the deal. It's not about the liquid. The whole trick is nanotechnology and slow release through nanotechnology. Remember Steve Martin? Right, I kind of feel like that with that arrow through my head with this thing on. Remember that on Saturday Night Live? And he had this thing, pardon me for doing an impression here, but he goes, "Let's get small." Remember that? You know, people who are my age recognize. So if you laugh, you know your age. I know your age. Right, let's get small.
Because it wasn't high, it was low.
It was low? I thought it was small. Anyway, he might have done both. I know he did Let's Get Small. And the Let's Get Small was about just, so that's what we're going to be doing. We're going to be getting small. I guess the drug company is going to hire Steve Martin to be their ad campaign guy, right? But that's where we're going to go, is with nanotechnology. And there's several drugs. So that Merck drug, the caspid inhibitor, doravirine, that in an RTI that looks pretty promising, all those drugs might be, BIC might be able to do it, maybe dolutegravir. They all, or cabo for that matter, might be able to reformulate. That's where I think we're headed. That's going to be kind of cool. And you could remove it if there's a problem. But then we don't have to get into this game, right, of are you taking your medicine, or, because that kind of puts a barrier between us, right, and it makes you feel bad, makes them feel bad, and but at least he's keeping his appointments. That's a good thing.
Picking up.
Yeah. By the way, Jeannie Marazzo's here. Could be giving them to family members. Here's an interesting study. Here's an interesting point, and it's a little bit about stigma, but it's more about human nature. Sorry if I'm going off script a little bit. I only have a few minutes left. Jeannie Marazzo's here, and she did a study called the Voice Study out of South Africa. It was a microbicide and oral tenofovir kind of comparison trial. And they found that the efficacy in terms of prevention as PrEP was only in the 20% range. For prevention of infection to an uninfected person, everything. Yeah, so let's just focus on the oral tenofovir. So they said they've been doing adherence counseling, and they've been doing adherence monitoring in two ways. They had an interview from the study site person, and then they had a separate form. And these women were keeping their appointments, and they were saying that their adherence was in the 90%+. Yet, the effectiveness of the intervention was only 20-some-odd percent. And then they looked at drug levels. And they saw that the drug levels mirrored the protective effect, which means that a whole bunch of people were claiming to their provider in this study that they didn't even have to be a part of, were not telling the truth. Well, there was that, but there are also pills, right? So it's not, so they're just looking at the pill arm. And you say, what in the world is going on here? And it's not 100% clear, but it's obvious that part of this is a dynamic of wanting to please the provider. This, what was that story? Oh, it was Treisman again. All right, so Treisman tells a story at the Hopkins Clinic, the Moore Clinic. It's now the Bartlett Clinic, right, in Baltimore. And a patient comes in just like what we were just talking about, your guy. And he swore up and down to Joel Gallant when Joel was there that I take my medicine. I do. And they look at refills. And it's all there, but there's nothing, and it's wild-type virus. So finally they go out and they check levels, and the levels are undetectable, right? So they go in to gently confront the patient, and they say, you know, you've been telling us for 6 months now that you're taking your medicine. We finally check the level, and it's zero. You can't be taking your medicine. He goes, well, that's right. He goes, so why did you tell us you were taking the medicine when you really weren't? He goes, because it seems so important to you. Right? So it's just real life, you know. It's just real life. Yes?
Florida, uh-huh. And I find more of the Haitian culture.
Is there culture in South Florida?
Yeah.
I'm just kidding. Just kidding.
And there's a very big, with the role of physicians, and there's a very big desire to please.
Yes.
So no matter what,
yeah,
they will try
in
and
Alabama
please
too.
You.
Yeah. So, you're the doc. Yes,
yeah,
sir. Yeah.
So
yes, ma'am. Yeah.
You ask them, do you speak English? It'll be yes.
Yeah.
Do you take your medicines? It'll be yes.
Yeah.
And what we mentioned, some will know about the drugs and will save the medicines to take it back to Haiti for a family member who needs it
not
more.
Not much you can do about that.
So
right.
The viral loads will be high, and they're picking up the medicines, but it's to go home with.
Yeah. So let me kind of wrap up the session with this. Time went by pretty quick. I guess I was telling too many jokes or something, or trying to. So here's something that kind of ties this together. Medicines only work if people take them, right? And to me, the number one reason why somebody doesn't take medicine or plays around by skipping one or two to see what happens is because that medicine they associate with making them feel bad. And this is where I love thinking about the lessons I've learned from Glenn Treisman. So a lot of you have seen this, so I apologize if you've heard this story before, but I think it's germane for those who haven't heard it. If we think about personalities on a bell-shaped curve, right? And we divide them into people who are consequence-driven on one extreme and people who are driven by their feelings on the other extreme, okay? And most of us are somewhere in the middle because it's a bell-shaped curve. You know, there's some things we're driven by how we feel. So, but on the consequence end of the spectrum might be your accountant who, if something's off by a penny, just drives them crazy. The consequence of being wrong is just so great. Or a pharmacist, for that matter, right? You want to make sure you get 100, not 99, not 101. You want 100 pills in every bottle, and that's your job. And they're consequence-driven. On the other end of the spectrum are feeling-driven people like Madonna or Britney Spears or maybe Donald Trump or Bill Clinton or someone. But you got the picture, the feeling-driven people. A lot of our patients are on the feeling end of the spectrum. And we're on the consequence-driven. How do you know? Because you wouldn't be in this room if along the way in training and school, if you had a test tomorrow, you probably didn't feel like studying. But the consequence of failure made you stay up all night, right? So you're consequence-driven. So the messaging to a patient like that is if you don't take your medicine, you're going to die. But the feeling-driven person would say, yeah, but that medicine makes me feel bad. And another way that Glenn describes this is that those people who are feeling-driven, oftentimes he'll say to them, we were all born with attributes, and some of us are given artistic power, and some of us are given... when you got your feelings, you got a double scoop. You feel more than the average person. If you feel good, you feel extra good. And if you feel bad, you feel extra bad. And that's really true. So he tells this great story, I'll end with, this great story that puts out there the difference between providers and a feeling-driven patient. This is a guy who he had treated for addiction and got them off cocaine. And the patient in the midnight, he started using again. And he came into Treisman and he says, Doc, I've been very nervous lately because I'm buying cocaine from the guy down the street who shot me. So Treisman just goes, well, why are you buying cocaine from a guy who shot you? Because he has cocaine. And Treisman is a little overweight. He says, look at me. I love prime rib. But if the maitre d' at the best prime rib restaurant in Baltimore shot me, I don't think I'd go back. And without hesitating, the patient goes, well, you know what, Doc? with an attitude like that, you'd be missing out on some good meat. So we gotta find the patients where they are, right? And I'm glad the session went the way it did, because I don't have much to tell you that you don't already know about antiretroviral therapy. You guys know what you're doing. And these problems that everyone sort of shared, and thank you for that, are problems that we've encountered in different ways. And I think just by airing it out can sort of help all of us do a little bit better job next time. Yeah, I'll let you have the last word.
I want to see what your thoughts on, let's say, someone who is well controlled and has unprotected sex gets infected with HIV too. What?
Has that happened?
Well, it might.
Okay, I'm not aware of it. There are people in West Africa where HIV2 is that are duly infected, so I guess it could happen. The chances are, though, that unless it depends on the drugs, because a lot of the drugs these days have activity against both. The drugs that notoriously didn't have activity for HIV2 are the non-nukes. Not all of them. Etravirine, for example, has activity, but Favrin's doesn't. But I think for most of the drugs we're using now, they're going to be active. But just to finish that thought, and then we'll end, because we started a minute late. We'll end right now. The thing to think about with superinfection of any sort, of HIV1 on top of HIV1 established infection or HIV2 on top of HIV1, it's really about niche space, that once someone's infected, especially if they're not on treatment, there's replication all the time. That virus is going nuts. It's doing everything it can to infect as much as it can. So in essence, a lot of the receptors, if not all of them, are sort of already consumed. And there's not a lot of room for this new virus that's coming in, a little bit of semen or whatever. There's no room for it. It just ain't going to happen often. It can happen, but it's not a common phenomenon. And so if that person is not on treatment, it's highly unlikely that an HIV2 infection is going to be superimposed on an HIV1 for that reason, and HIV2 is typically a little bit less virulent than HIV1, a little bit less infectious. Flip it around, if somebody's got HIV2 first, it's possible, but it's still unlikely. And if they're on treatment, it's almost impossible, as we've heard, like from PrEP. If people are taking their medicine, even if it's just a couple drugs, it's unlikely they're going to be super infected. It could happen, but I don't think so. Yes?
I have a question, sorry. I have a diabetic patient who is on hemodialysis and does not want to be on Epivir. Is Prescobix, Divicae okay?
Generally, yes, although I'd want to triple check. That's the type of question I talk with a pharmacist about every time, because I can't keep all that straight. So you have a pharmacist who works with you? All right, then I would get on the hotline and talk to the pharmacist there.
I have a dialysis patient that's
on those two drugs and doing okay. There's your pharmacist, Dr. Loreen from Alabama. All right.
Normal doses.
Great. Okay, but I usually look it up because I can't keep that stuff in my head. Great. Thank you all very much for hanging in there with me and putting up with my nonsense.